I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Maybe you've seen it on a bumper sticker or heard it yelled to you after getting distracted reading that bumper sticker and coming uncomfortably close to hitting someone on a bicycle. Share the road. It's more than a catchphrase, a meme, or a suggestion. It's also a reality. Anyone who ventures out onto Vermont's roadways is obligated to follow, whether you're riding a bike, driving a car, or just taking a walk. It's an issue that may not seem like a big deal during Vermont's long, cold winters when it's mostly vehicles navigating the state's highways, byways, and back roads. But when the weather warms up, you're bound to see more walkers, runners, bicyclists, scooter riders, and e-bikers claiming space on the road. And there are rules for navigating all that increased traffic. We're going to review those rules of the road today, and joining me from our studios in Montpelier are two experts who can answer any questions that you may have on those rules. John Kaplan is the Bicycle and Pedestrian Program Manager at the Vermont Agency of Transportation, or VTrans. He's also an avid cyclist, and John, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Mitch.
Also, no stranger to two-wheeled transportation, we're joined by Ross Saxton. He's the manager of program development at Local Motion, a nonprofit advocacy group focused on biking and active transportation. Ross, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, John Kaplan, let me start with you. There are specific rules and regulations regarding how to navigate Vermont's roads, not just for motorists. What would you say is one of the most common rules that people either get wrong or don't know about that they really should?
Let's see. Well, I'd say an important one is regarding bicyclists is that they in general have to follow all the same rules of the road as a motor vehicle. I think that is pretty commonly known. I have seen and I know of some people who maybe advise their kids to ride against traffic. Mm-hmm. I have seen that happen. That's actually a very dangerous behavior because it puts bicyclists in a place where motorists aren't expecting them to be coming from. So they may not look in the direction, you know, motorists are generally looking for other traffic when they're going to make a turn or something. So I think that's maybe a misperception that's out there that it's safer to ride against traffic, but that's definitely a dangerous behavior.
Ride with the traffic when you can, yeah. Well, are there any easy ways to access resources for people who want to familiarize themselves with these rules?
Sure. So we have a link on our VTrans bicycle and pedestrian program page that takes you to a number of resources that we've put together on sharing the road. We have actually a brochure called our Share the Road brochure, and we also have a bicycle commuters guide. And then we collaborated with Local Motion a couple of years ago. They had a publication called The Parents' Guide to Safe Bicycling, which was geared to parents working with younger kids to sort of get them in the habit of biking and doing it safely.
And we should let you know, too, that we've got a link to what you were just talking about, John, on our website at vpr.org. So you can check it out and jump over there if you want to check out these rules and an easy way to access them. Ross Saxton, let me ask you this. There are the rules of the road that John was just talking about, and then there's etiquette, which is sort of the unwritten rules in a way. And I'm wondering about there's that gray area and how you would sort of differentiate between the rules of the road that everybody has to follow and some of those unwritten rules that should really help, even though they're not written down in stone.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's really good to recognize is although someone on a bike needs to follow the same rules as someone driving, and oftentimes that person is doing both things, both driving a car and a bike during the same day. I always like to recognize that.
Yeah.
But the mutual respect between the two, say someone's on a bike and someone's in a car, making sure that you acknowledge that each other has that right to be on the road and that the bicyclist is the more vulnerable user or the pedestrian is the more vulnerable person out there. So if something happens, they hit a patch of gravel or something, they go down, the person in the car is probably going to be a lot safer than the person in the biker. Mm-hmm. So just remembering that the cyclist or the pedestrian is the vulnerable person there, but still needs to follow the rules, of course, to keep everyone safe.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because sometimes you'll hear drivers say, you know, I saw a bicyclist come up to a stop sign and just go right through it. I don't, you know, and they'll get mad because they'll say, I have to make that stop. It can't be a rolling stop. It's got to be complete stop. Why doesn't the bicyclist have to do that? And they do, right?
Yeah, in Vermont they do. There's some states like Idaho. Some people refer to it as the Idaho stop, where it is legal to be on a bike and use a stop sign more like a yield sign. Maybe that will happen in Vermont sometime. And that's acknowledging that a cyclist is not the same as a car. They're very two different things. So how you operate a bike is very different from how you operate a car. So currently, yes, now you do. If you're on a bike, you do need to stop at a stop sign.
We are getting so many comments on our Facebook page and elsewhere about this. People are really concerned about these issues, more so, frankly, than I thought they would be. But this is a big deal. Now, we heard from Jamie from Georgia Center, who said, I don't feel safe driving on Vermont roads due to their condition. Vermont lacks the ability to get them repaired properly and to the same standards we require for our vehicles, never mind for bikes. And cyclists don't pay to keep their bikes registered. That's something I hadn't thought about, John Kaplan. Is that something cyclists are supposed to do, pay to keep their bikes registered?
Not currently in Vermont. I know that since I've been with VTrans, the idea of registering bikes has come up in the legislature several times, but it has never gained enough support to get passed. Largely, I think there's some thought that that might actually discourage bicycling, and then also questions about how that might impact, you know, tourists who are coming to the state. And bicycle tourism is a part of our Vermont economy, so we don't want to discourage that.
Right. Did it used to be the case, though, that people had to register their bikes? Has that changed in Vermont, to your knowledge?
A couple hundred years ago, actually.
Is that right?
Yeah, a staff meeting this morning, we're looking at a really old map from the late 1800s that showed bicycle routes, which were four bikes only, no cars in southern Vermont. And I think it was like 5 cents or 10 cents to register. And I think we heard there's something like 30,000 of those registrations happened in the late 19th century. And a lot of these roads that were just for bikes are now actually roads that we recognize as for cars. So it's interesting how that kind of transitioned over many decades.
We heard from Elizabeth in Middlebury, who emailed us, and she wants to know, she says, as a former cyclist, I am sympathetic, but many bicyclists frequently flout traffic laws. I have never seen law enforcement, Elizabeth says, take any kind of action, even when the violation is directly in front of them. Why aren't bicyclists required to follow the law? And I think she's specifically asking, why aren't they ticketed? John Kaplan, is this something you can speak to?
I think that would be, you know, a little bit more of a question for, you know, the law enforcement community. I know in talking with them, certainly they would have the right to ticket a bicyclist or give them a warning. And I would encourage that if they saw behavior that was especially unsafe. I think it's probably a matter of priority. They have a lot of different things that they're concerned with. So I think it just boils down to kind of a resource issue where it's tough for them to do everything that is expected of them.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's asking law enforcement to go out and specifically start locking up bicycle riders who are flouting the law. But again, we don't want to make light of this because these can be really potentially very, very dangerous situations, and people can get really hurt. They can be killed when people aren't paying attention or watching these rules of the road very well. We also heard from I think it's Steve, who emailed and said, I was really disappointed to learn how weak or vague Vermont's laws are with regard to cyclists. Our statutes state motorists shall exercise due care, which includes increasing clearance to pass the vulnerable user safely. That is very open to interpretation, according to Steve. Maybe this is the norm, but I thought some states mandate minimum clearances between motor vehicles and bicycles. What is the case in Vermont? Can either of you answer that question?
This is John. So that due care language that's in our state statute, and I was down in the legislature when that vulnerable user law was making its way through the process down there, that was debated quite a bit. And that is a very typical standard of safety that's in a lot of other statutes around motor vehicle use. And so I know that law enforcement supported using that language. The person's right that a lot of states do have a required distance that you have to pass a vulnerable user. Like 3 feet is fairly common in other states. We do have language in our statute that says you pass with increased clearance and a recommended 4 feet. So it's not a requirement, but there is a distance that's specified in our law as a recommendation.
I find that really interesting because I do try to give, when I'm in a car, a really wide berth to a cyclist on the roads. Because some of these roads, you know, in Vermont, they're very hilly, they're very narrow. There really isn't necessarily a shoulder for the bicyclist to ride in. You know, so I'll take that wide, wide berth to go around them. But then I'm thinking, well, I'm in the wrong lane now. You know, I'm in a dangerous position myself because I've looked ahead. There isn't a car coming the other direction. But what if there was? So what kind of a gray area do you have there? I mean, you're doing one thing by keeping the bicyclist safe, but then maybe you're doing something else by putting yourself in danger as a driver.
Yeah. So our statute actually is pretty clear about that. So it does allow drivers to cross like a double yellow line to pass a vulnerable user. But it also says that you need to wait until you have a safe opportunity to do that. So actually, Ross and I were just talking about this as a cyclist. I actually feel that most of the interactions I've had with cars passing me, I feel very safe in that drivers are giving me that wide berth. But a lot of times in a situation where they're going around a blind corner or coming up to a hill where they can't tell if there's going to be an oncoming car. And of course, that's not safe for them. And it might not be safe for me as the bicyclist, too, if a crash were to happen. So I guess my sort of this kind of gets to the etiquette side of things. I would just say to the motorist in that situation to just, you know, it's really going to be just a couple of seconds until they have that clear view to know that it's going to be safe to pass. And I think some of all this comes down to kind of what I've seen is kind of a growing maybe like impatience on the roadways amongst, you know, all users. So it's just sort of wait that extra couple of seconds to make sure that, you know, you're safe and you're keeping the bicyclist or other vulnerable user that you're passing safe
as
well.
Sounds like a good suggestion indeed. We got a lot of calls coming in. Let's go to Matt, who is in Windsor. Hi, Matt. You're on Vermont Edition.
Hey, good afternoon. I just like to make a point. Now, you say they got to follow the rules of the road, the bicyclists do. Then why do I commonly see two or three wide when there's a pack of bicyclists? Why don't they drive single file like everybody else has to?
Okay. Which of you like to take that one?
Yeah, I can mention what the law is in most cases. In a lot of state roads, it's two abreast. So you can ride two riders wide, and you know there are certain situations where that might not make sense around a corner where the shoulder dips down to maybe a foot or sometimes less in some of our roads. So three abreast typically is not a great idea. You see it definitely often, which is unfortunate. So definitely encourage groups of riders, especially to ride at, you know, two across at the most, single file where things are a little narrower, especially once you get into downtowns and things get a little dicier with parked cars and whatnot. So, yeah, definitely recommend going one abreast where best or two at the most.
So far, we're hearing a lot of people complaining about cyclists, so I want to give a little equal time here because we did hear from Chris on Facebook who says, as a person on a bicycle, what scares me the most are large pickup trucks with mirrors that reach out like wings for several feet. They're right at the level of my head. Bicycles are legally considered a vehicle and entitled to the whole lane. People who drive trucks and cars need to understand that and drive as if it was their son or daughter on the bike. Let's go back to the phones. Nichol is on the line from Guilford. Hi, Nichol.
Hi. Hi. I had a couple quick questions. The first, I was wondering about special rules for recumbent bikes. As a driver, as Mitch noted, on a lot of hilly, narrow, twisty roads, I've come up on recumbent bikes where there's nothing on the bike or the rider that's more than, say, 18 inches above the ground, but yet they still didn't have flags or anything like that. And it's very easy to come upon one of these bikes without even noticing it. And as Mitch said, on some of these roads, that can be kind of dangerous. Another issue as a driver, I've noticed, this is sort of strange, but at this time of year, A lot of back roads are, people use them like for running, and that's fine. But this time of year where when you're driving down the roads, it can be, you can be in bright, sunny, almost blindingly bright sunlight, and then suddenly you're under trees. It's almost as if you're driving in a tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to see. I've often seen people out and they're like in black running suits, and it's almost impossible to see them. I don't know what the rules are here, but, you know, people should bear in mind that this time of year, without running, they should wear seeable clothes.
That's an important point, Nichol. Let's have our guest answer your first question about recumbent bikes first, because I agree with Nichol. Those are different bikes. Let's describe what those are. They are harder to see, I think, than riding a regular bicycle, I would imagine.
Yeah, Mitch, so to my knowledge, Vermont law does not distinguish recumbents from other bicycles. There's no special requirements for them. I would say a lot of the recumbents that I've seen, and just for listeners, a recumbent is a bike that rather than sort of being up on the saddle, they generally have a seat, more, you know, like a car seat almost, that's attached to the frame, and they're much lower to the ground, as the caller stated. And a lot of times they're used by people who may have like back problems or other disabilities, where riding a recumbent is the only way they can ride. There's also like hand cycles that people who have like a spine injury will use. But they are low to the ground. A lot of times I see them with a flag, as mm-hmm. as the caller mentioned. But our state law does not distinguish them from other bicycles.
And as far as jogging on a road where you may be going from that extreme light to like sort of the darkness tunnel Nichol was talking about, any suggestions for clothing on the best kind of clothing to wear? I hadn't really thought about that issue, but he's right. It could happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Ross might have more to say about this, but there's no sort of statutory requirement, but certainly all of our education materials that we have out there talk about wearing, you know, bright or light colored clothing to combat that.
Even in daytime. Okay. Joining us now on the line is Jeff Dixon. He is the chair of the Vermont Mountain Bike Association's Board of Directors. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
So how should mountain bikers treat other people on the trail and each other in general?
Well, I think it, you know, goes without saying, similar to one of your earlier panelists, it's all about treating each other with respect. That goes for mountain bikers treating each other with respect, mountain bikers treating other pedestrians and trail users with respect, and, you know, recognizing that everyone's out there trying to enjoy the trails and, you know, try to accommodate each other and do it in a safe way.
One of the things I know about mountain bikes is that they can often cross private land. I'm wondering what bikers should do before heading out on trails that might cross over onto someone's private property.
Yeah, definitely. A large proportion, actually, of mountain bike trails in Vermont, including a large proportion of the chapter networks throughout the state, are on private land. So there are a couple important things. Number one, regardless of whether it's public or private land, it's important to be aware of the trail conditions. Check the trail conditions before you go. We've had a very wet spring, obviously, and everyone's chomping at the bit to ride some drier trails. But
yeah.
There's a lot of mud on the trail still. And so being aware of whether the trails are even open or not by checking with your local chapter is a big one. Number two, for private landowners, but also on state land, knowing where it's acceptable to park is important. We don't want people parking in unauthorized areas, in rights of way, things like that. And then it might not always come to mind, but certainly being aware of when and where it's appropriate to change your clothes, for example, if you're just getting out of the car after work and doing so discreetly. is important too.
I don't mean to laugh. I'm sorry. I'm just, you know, these are things that I really hadn't thought about, but you know, you may be right. If you're out there getting changed into your biking gear, make sure you've thought that through before doing so. Jeff, one of the things I'm concerned about when it comes to mountain biking, and I think this may be a little bit different once you're on the trail, you're probably less likely to encounter any problems with vehicles, although there are ATVs, there are off-road vehicles, but mostly it's going to be problems with people who are walking a trail and then those people on mountain bikes. So are there any sort of etiquette or rules of the trail, if you will, when it comes to pedestrians and mountain bikers?
Definitely. None of it is set in stone, but the generally accepted etiquette is that bikers should try to yield to people on foot. Of course, you know, if a person on foot steps out of the way to let the biker pass, by all means, do it. But in general, bikers should yield to walkers. Walkers and bikers should both yield to horseback riders, for example. That's kind of the least maneuverable of the three participants. So get off the trail to let horses pass. And then vis-a-vis bikes, a lot of it is sort of dependent on the geography and where you're going. But the general rule would be that riders riding downhill should yield to riders coming up the hill. And that generally keeps people safe and allows people to enjoy the trail the best.
Excellent. Okay, Jeff, thank you so much. Jeff Dixon is the chair of the Vermont Mountain Bike Association's Board of Directors. Thanks for the time, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
You know, and I'm really happy that Jeff mentioned just now horses, because we are getting a lot of email and Facebook messages about horses. Again, something I didn't naturally think of when it came to these kind of conflicts. Jeanette in Northfield sent us this email. I'd like to remind people with whom we share multi-use trails that horses really, really like the calming voice of humans. They sometimes can't figure out bikes, hikers with backpacks, or strollers. We equestrians also like it when people interact with us as well. And then we have Susan in Derby emailing saying, please give time to our beloved horses, donkeys, and mules, and the people who accompany them on the roadways. Equines have right of way, and yielding from a pedestrian is different than from a bicyclist. So, John Kaplan, let me ask you, is that correct? Is Susan in Derby right that equines have the right of way?
Well, I'm not sure about right of way. I guess technically that would be true. I reached out to my sister, who does a lot of stuff with horses, not long before the show to check in about that. And she did send me an excerpt from state statute that talks about it does say the operator of a motor vehicle shall yield to any animals being herded on or across a highway.
Oh.
So there is some state law around that. And then, as you just heard, there's some etiquette about especially coming up behind horses, because
yes,
they don't have good, you know, vision, and, they'll startle. So, my sister pointed out that coming up behind horses is something you want to be cautious about.
Yeah, and I think that's reflected in something that we heard from Amy in West Windsor. She emailed us and said that horses are flight animals. So a speeding car or a whizzing bike from behind, as you just said, can be equivalent to an attack to them. Motorists, please go even slower than you think you need to. Swing wide past the horse and do not go roaring off immediately after you pass. Let's remember our equine friends as well, as long as we are out there. Let's go to the phones. We have Rick on the line from South Burlington. Hi, Rick.
Hello. I just wanted to make the point that cars and bicyclists get on best when they each have safe, separated travel distance between them. To do that, you need about 35 or 36 feet to accommodate a car and bicyclist going in one direction, passing four abreast a car and bicyclist going the opposite direction. Most of Vermont's roads are less than 28 feet or less in width. So it puts a premium on all of us, motorists and bicyclists, to be really respectful, because we are forced into an unsafe situation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call, Rick. I appreciate that. Ross, it looks like that sort of reflects what you were saying about, and what John was saying too, about just respect. A lot of this can't be regulated necessarily because of the quirks and the road distance and all that sort of thing. It's a matter of taking that time to think it through and have the respect, I imagine.
Yeah, I think about the psychology a lot, too, of being in a car. You're kind of in this bubble. And there's a gentleman down in Brattleboro named Dave Cohen of V-Bike, who is a psychologist, talks a lot about this. So I encourage you to go check out what he talks about. But basically, when you're in this car and separated from other people and other cyclists and pedestrians, there's almost this sense of that bike person on a bike, just being a bike and not actually a person. And there's been a lot of research behind this. So one thing when I'm driving down the road is I always remember that's a person in that car, or that's a person on the bike, or that thing there, that shadowy thing, maybe the sun's blinding, that's a person.
Right.
And that brings it back into perspective of being really extra cautious. You know, that person's maybe my neighbor, they've got kids, they've got parents, you know, people love them. We just need to be really careful about them. And also that brings up the point of having really clear communication, because once you do recognize that's a person right there, you can then start communicating with them a little more directly. So say I'm on a bike and I'm taking a left and there's someone coming in the opposite direction. I want to make sure that they know that I'm taking a left. So I'm going to try to make eye contact and I'm going to signal. And that's really important for the motorist as well, or if you're running. So that communication between everybody on the road is just so important. And people are getting a little better at it. I think we could all do even better. So I think that's something we can work on.
I think we could all do a little better at that, remembering that everyone is a person, even when you get beyond the whole bike and road issue. You make an excellent point. It seems so obvious on the surface of it, and that yet when you really think about it, we could all think about that a little bit more. Patrick is on the line from Winooski. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, my question today is about e-bikes. So I currently ride a dual sport motorcycle around Vermont, exploring class 4 roads and stuff all the time. And I'm really interested in this new class of e-bike, which really falls between a bicycle and a motorcycle. It looks like a bicycle. It's very light, but it doesn't have pedals, for example. And I'm curious about the legality and how I'd be able to share the road on such a bike.
Thanks for that call, Patrick. Which of you gentlemen would like to tackle that question first?
Well, this is John again. I kind of knew that something about e-bikes would come up. Certainly the technology is rapidly changing around e-bikes, and they're becoming more affordable, better equipment and so forth. As far as state law goes, there is a definition of a motor-assisted bicycle, and it gets to how much power they have in terms of watts and horsepower. It's 1.3 horsepower is the maximum, and also a speed limit that they're not able to go more than 20 miles an hour when ridden by an operator who weighs 170 pounds. That's the state statute language.
John, how does that compare the speed issue with the e-bike, let's say, to a moped?
That is a good question. I would imagine that a moped could go faster. The other thing with the electric assist bikes is that in general you have to be pedaling for them to work. So it's not like hopping on a device where all you have to do is twist a throttle and you're going. And then I'm not sure about the device that the caller was trying to describe, but there is sort of a whole new class of devices, personal transportation devices, I think is the term being used for them, like electric scooters, hoverboards,
Segways,
exactly. So I think at this point our statute doesn't really address those, but that is definitely an emerging issue that we're keeping an eye on.
And Vermont does do a little bit of a better job than other states in defining what the different classes of e-bikes are. There's actually three different classes, which you can look up online. And there is a point at which if there's too much wattage within the motor, or it goes faster than 20 miles per hour, then you have to register it as a moped. And that's where the difference is. And some e-bikes do have throttles on them. So But you do have to pedal it for it to count as an e-bike.
Ross, are you seeing more and more people using e-bikes, you know, just through your work with Local Motion? It's not something that Local Motion provides, right?
Oh, we see a lot of e-bikes out there, and especially when they're on a cargo e-bike, you know, around Burlington and Montpelier, Brattleboro, Middlebury, all over the place. We're seeing people, parents with their kids on the back too. So you actually get these kid seats that are on the back. I see people carrying lumber around with them or Christmas trees or all kinds of things. People are using them for hunting now as well to get the deer out of the woods.
That's concerning, though. I mean, because these things, I've seen them, they zip along pretty quickly. Whether or not they're faster than a moped, they appear to me to be the kind of thing that can come upon you really quickly. I wonder how much training it takes to operate one of these things, you know, in the correct way. I don't know. I've never been on an e-bike, but I know they are gaining in popularity.
Yeah, they're pretty intuitive to use. And if you look at all the studies of the average speed of someone on an e-bike versus a conventional bike, interestingly, people actually on the e-bike are going slower than on a conventional bike. And it's kind of because of the demographic of people, for the most part, who are using e-bikes. A lot of people literally would not be biking if they didn't have an e-bike because they've got knee issues or an ankle pain, or they're just not as fit as they used to be. So they're getting on an e-bike as a way to actually ride a bike. You know, without it, they wouldn't ride at all.
And you want people to get out there.
We want people to get out there, yeah. Right. So we actually been doing, you asked, can we get people on e-bikes? We actually do. We have multiple what we call e-bike lending libraries. One's based out of our Burlington office where you can come and borrow an e-bike for free. We have a traveling e-bike library that we just started this year that's currently in Middlebury that got booked up real quick. It's coming to Montpelier next month, and then it's going to be in the Upper Valley and possibly some other towns. And we want people to get on those e-bikes and try it out before investing into it because it's, you know, they do cost a little bit of money. You're starting out at $1,400, $1,500 at the least. You know, there's some rebates. Green Mountain Power just came out with an e-bike rebate, which is great. Burlington Electric has had theirs for a couple of years. VSECU provides low-interest loans, so you can get them too. So there's ways that you can get them pretty affordably. But they are getting people out more frequently, and they're going farther. And they're a really great way to literally replace a car. I know people who bought an e-bike and replaced their second car, so they're saving a ton of money. They're healthier, and they're happier because of it too.
I want to get to one more call really quick. We're running out of time, but Jeannie is on the line in Burlington. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about bike commuting in a city like Burlington. And there's a lot of traffic in certain places, and that like gets backed up, and if I on my bike follow the laws of traffic, I wait my line at the four-way stop or the traffic light or whatever, I end up sitting on my bike breathing car exhaust for like 10 minutes and my commute takes a lot longer. So I'm wondering what can be done to, you know, help the bike commute be better but also be legal and safe.
Okay, Jeannie, thank you for the call. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are running out of time. Just a few seconds here. Ross Saxton, do you think you can answer that question?
Yeah, we just did a forum about this, actually, a blog post. We looked at the rules of can you pass cars on the right as a bike when you're on a bike? And that is one way to speed up the commute a little bit. It's not totally as safe as it is staying behind a car, so you need to be really careful. But if there's room, you can pass a line of cars on the right. But you just got to be really aware of your surroundings if you're going to do that. The other way is projects that we work with VTrans and municipalities with to make more bike lanes. And someone mentioned before protected bike lanes. Those are really important to getting, especially new people who want to go biking, who haven't done it in a while, to get them out there. So there's projects that are happening around the
state. Sounds a lot better than breathing exhaust fumes for sure. That's Ross Saxton, Manager of Program Development at Local Motion. Thank you so much for the time, Ross.
Yeah, thanks.
And John Kaplan, Bicycle and Pedestrian Program Manager at VTrans. John, thank you so much for your insights today.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the opportunity, Mitch.